Colonel Marini, Reel 17. What happened to you next after?
Well, John Donne was a fairly restful period apart from shelling, and eventually, we'd gone into John Donne towards the end of June, and around about mid-July, we were put into divisional reserve in the equivalent of the echelon behind the line, and it was behind the American position, which we'd gone further west. One of the positions was Jane Russell, two people, it was fairly close to the end of the war. If it wasn't the last night, it was certainly very, very close to the end. I have always been under the impression that it was the last night of the war, because we were celebrating. We knew that the ceasefire was going to be at a certain time that night, and we were all celebrating that fact. And the Chinese put in a big final push in an effort to rearrange the ceasefire line, and they pushed against the American Marines, who were on this OPLR, MLR defensive position. And it eventually finished up that they were getting very close to where we were on the echelon. So we were called out. It was somewhat dicey, actually, because a lot of people had been celebrating well, and I remember I was one of them. You know, it was not a night that I would prefer to be called out on. I got my platoon out and on the road, and I noticed that there was one of them was carrying a pickaxe, and I said to him, "What do you want? Where'd you go?" He said, "Go away in army language here." So I said, "Pardon?" And he said it again. So I took him out of the tomb, and I said, "Say that again." And he did. So I hit him. And I missed his thing. And I hit his teeth out of him straight on the thing. He was about to do the same. And I heard a voice behind me. "Fly up, your boy." And it was some bloke in North Lander, Captain Moses. And I said, "Well, take him back and put him on charge for being the combat and prisoners." But that was just told him. And then by that time, I had to run Captain Truman.
Do you remember his name, this chap?
A chap called Gates, yes. Gates. He just come out of, I think the reason why he was carrying a pickup was that he just come out of the Nick. I think he was one of the bad apples at the time. And they refused to give him a gun because he might have done something silly with it, you know, taking his revenge on somebody. So it wasn't really entirely his fault that he was just unarmed. Anyway, we went on, and we were occupying positions about 400 or 500 yards behind the Marines. It was being shelled. But on the way to our position, Savage, Jim Lovage's batman, one driver, he wandered into one of the minefields. And by the time I got up to where he was, there were a couple of lads sitting beside the hill gap, just above where he was standing, where he was flying. He must have been in about 20 yards, 25 yards. And they were trying to cheer up, so I joined them and did the same, and said that they were about radio for a sapper officer to come up and try and get out. Never occurred to me to do it myself, because I loathe mines, I hate them. I suppose, you know, if I'd ever been getting a VC or something, I would have done it, but I didn't have to do it for last night of the war. Anyway, this chap came up, and without any hesitation whatsoever, just went straight in, put him in, and he brought him out. I didn't see him bring him out because I was leaving his wife too. But I said to Jim, you know, that boy deserves something. I don't know whether he ever did get anything or not. I told Jim what happened. I don't know what he did, but he certainly deserved a decent MC for that particular action. You know, if he did do that sort of thing. I know engineer officers are part of their job and all the rest of it, but it was a very day back.
What kind of mines were laid?
At first now.
Were there these that sprung up and exploded in midair? Was he killed? Did he die?
Very, very badly. His leg got out, lost his leg, lost part of his hand, lost sight of one eye. And he was a real wreck.
And these were buried, you couldn't see them. They were there, but you couldn't see them. They were buried, the mines.
They were just part buried. So all of us showing, if anything, would be just a little cap, which is the detonator. But by probing, you don't probe too fiercely, otherwise you hit the detonator panel. The personnel mine needed the weight of a person to fill them up.
How far apart were they were they buried?
We never laid anywhere. Most of the ones that were laid on before we got there. All we did was wiring. So, but I would think probably about a yard and a half apart in a pattern. So you get two there, so we were overlapping the gaps. You couldn't walk straight through a gap, even that way. But the main danger was that some of these things had been put there quite some time before, and they move, especially on the hillside and that sort of thing. So, you know, the only way you could clear a mine scene like that would be by probing every inch of the cut of field. You couldn't even work out a pattern. You could see, there should be another one there. It wouldn't necessarily mean it was, because it would creep, it would creep. So, anyway, we occupied the position behind they did, in fact, eventually hold the Chinese and didn't come up. It was close enough. So, next day we went back to our position, our BS. We continued to do our sort of celebrations for the end of the. This was about the time actually when there was a tremendous storm, a terrible storm, which absolutely flattened AS, and there was a sea of mud. We couldn't move with it. I can't remember exactly when this was. I think it was before the events I've just been talking about. But I remember the rain. It was torrential. George Flanagan back in the BS line. He spent the rest of the week sorting out the kit and trying to sort the place out. Then on the 27th of July, a ceasefire took effect at 10 o'clock on the 27th of July, and our six bugles sounded the ceasefire in the division lines. The war had lasted 1,301 days, and we had 21 killed in action, 124 wounded in action, and 3 missing. 9 major gunshot wounds, that were DSO eventually commander.
Relief when it was announced? Was it a relief to the battalion when it was announced the end of the war?
Oh, yes, I think so, yes. Yes. I mean, we'd done our work, and we knew it was going to happen sometime. It wasn't the end of the war, it was just this endless hostility. They agreed to stop fighting, that was all it was. Yes, oh, yes. We went to various parties, the Oxygen Bike, just to parties there. Actually, Air Company, we went back to our old staging post, Britannia Camp, and our job then was to rebuild the wire and get the place properly organised for reception of the POWs that were being released. And we were the sort of company that was responsible for the administration of the camp. And protection of it. indeed, shortly after the 27th, we went back on the 29th of July. And shortly after that, the POW started to come out. The bulk of them, of course, were Gloucesters, and included Colonel Cowan and a chap called Farah Hockley, and basically finished up for Germany.
What condition were they in? Did you see them?
Yes, I mean, even Farah Hockley, who had a fairly rough time, he didn't look as though he'd been beaten up in the event. Khan was very, very quiet. Rather, I gather he was that sort of man anyway. He was very quiet. He didn't have much to say. If you asked him a question, Farah Hockley usually answered it. He was a very bushy man, Farah Hockley. He always had plenty to say. And the soldiers, I mean, there must have been something like 500 odd soldiers came out of the Gloucesters. And this took something like 3 weeks to get all this lot out. And while we were there, General Upridge woke me up one night. He said, we've been asked to send a party of soldiers back to 355 to see if we can find any evidence of Radcliffe and what happened to John Sorrell and all this sort of thing. And he said, I want you to go. We're providing the man to the aid company. Just take about 15 or so books up. First light tomorrow morning, and this was about 10 o'clock at night, he was telling me. So we did that, and went back and got back onto the old positions. And it was then that we found the boat gun just in front of where Johnny Trasola had been killed. I think there's certainly one or two or three boat guns which are in the museum at the moment. We didn't find any other evidence. We went right down the ridge. The main worry was for mines again, you know. So I said to them, don't worry, you stupid. Just have a look. These are the areas you want to look in. And watch where you place your feet and establish. So I went down the ridge and I couldn't see anything, any form of evidence of what actually happened.
Were the Chinese still moving around in the area as well?
Yes, they were looking at us, wondering what was going on. It wasn't unoccupied, actually. Our positions were unoccupied. I don't know, we were relieved by the Warwicks. And I don't know what happened, they went up into the line and occupied them. But there was a general withdrawal from the then front line to, I think, about 1,000 yards on either side, which meant that. The old line was virtually unoccupied. We eventually left early September, or October, July, August, September. Yes.
And that was to come home, was it?
Yes, but we left Britannia Camp first, around about the end, the middle of August. Middle of August, I think, after the POW was tied up. While we were in Britannia Camp, we did get a lot of various types of heads of people from Canadian, Australian, English, largely for the POW.
What was the process? Did they just come down the road into the camp? Had they been released farther up?
They were released at Freedom Bridge. Still there, the Pam and John, and it was supposed to be a swap. All those people who wished to go from the Korean, North Korean, what was exchanged, and the big propaganda, throwing away their Western Guard, the Stag Maker, and all that sort of thing. And our people were brought together. They marched over the bridge and were picked up by.
And was it in the tents? Was it a tented camp?
Yes.
First made of.
There were two buildings, wooden buildings, but otherwise
tents. A fuss made of them when they came into camp? Was there a great deal laid on for them?
Oh, yes. It was fed well and looked
And were they debriefed in the camp, or did they move on to another place for that? Had you been able to form an opinion of the Chinese soldier that was were your antagonists?
Well, you always respect an enemy. Behoves you to respect an enemy, but they were regarded as chinks. You know, they were expendable chinks. Not really admired. Just wary. One was wary of them. They knew that they could hurt. Well, they'd be wary of the bees. Bit of a joke, really. It wasn't a good idea to expand too much on that idea that they were a joke, but they were an enemy. But they weren't taking company seriously.
And basically cannon fodder, in a sense, that when they came into action. They've got a lot of them, though, haven't they? A lot of men to expend. Yeah, you've mentioned the American soldier as you know, as you've moved into positions and come into contact with them. Were there a poor quality infantry soldier?
I think they were. Yes, they never ceased to be amazed at how brave they were, and what they were doing really was nothing. You know, they seemed to live on the nerves. There's a lot of shouting and nervousness and street dashing around seemed to no great purpose. Their food arrangements were ridiculous, really. They had all their stuff set up in hot boxes and then distributed from a hot box onto a platter. I don't know what sort of mash, but there was a platter on which everything was put. Meat, veggies, gravy, pudding, everything. The only thing, the other thing that they had was the mug for the coffee. And it was just a glutinous mass. The only time that we, the food was magnificent. The logistical side of the American Army is fantastic, absolutely efficient as it can possibly be. Unlimited money spent on it. But it was the quality of the fighting soldiers that was so bad. And you could never really rely on the Americans to stiffen up the defense. You know, this is exactly what happened with the Gloucesters and the Normandies. They were left to get out of it. And the Americans pulled back out of the way and left them. And it was a frustrating situation to be in, because the Americans were convinced that they were the bravest soldiers, that they were just as. You've got signs like this is the furthest forward 4.2 mortar platoon in Korea. So what? And there was another sign that's rather amusing. The 2nd Infantry Division, which was the one that we had most to do with, their insignia, they have these huge insignias on their arms, with an Indian chief's head, with second to none underneath. They had one of these things up there, the regional headquarters, fairly far behind the line, started about where the mobile baths were. And it was a huge fort, probably as big as that wall. And again, the head of Pat Lawrence and second to none. And a bit further along the line was a New Zealand battery along the valley. The New Zealand battery was none of it was only up for about 3 or 4 days until some general noticed it and took it down. But that was, you know, the whole thing was a sort of Hollywood thing, as far as I was concerned. And I think possibly the quality of truth was a little better than those that actually turned out to fight the war at the very beginning of the first started. Because by that time they had a little bit of experience, a little bit more experience than their generals were. generally speaking, they are not a reliable ally. You never knew really what they were going to do next. Completely opposite.
Did you meet any of the American generals? Did they visit you? Were they impressive?
Well, Mark Clark was very good. They were pleasant.
Because they were wartime leaders, weren't they?
Yes.
The Australians, we've talked about.
And the New Zealanders. There were two groups of individuals which personally I think the Italian generals had the highest regard for. The New Zealanders were just efficient. They were damn good soldiers and they were their job artillery. That was what they provided. They were absolutely first class, really were marvelous. And I met two or three New Zealanders when we went back on the cruise. I said, I went out of my way to say, fair, well, I knew him, but far on, so these were absolutely marvelous. And the Aussies were just little mad. They just loved the fight. I told you, they used to come and watch the shelling. Come over the hoop, you can watch the shelling, of course. All the time. And on patrol they were mad as well. The fighting patrol by then, so used to go out and challenge the Chinese to try and fight the bats. The Canadians, the PPCLI were all right. The Bandus were a bit dicey. They were obsessed by the possibility of being attacked, and they absolutely surrounded themselves with napalm and boom traps. And if you had to go and visit them for the liaison reason or anything like that, you had to get a guide and put him in front so that the visitor went off. they had tripwires all over the place.
And this was a Canadian regiment, was it?
Yes, yeah. And it was 20 seconds. Royal 20 seconds E regiment, and the French. French were 22 of that, Bandus. PPCLI was a Royal Canadian Regiment, didn't have all that amount to do with them, but PPCLI we respected. I met a lot of them when I went on leave. But the Bandus, mostly French anyway, spoke French, and they wouldn't speak anything else, or if they did, it was as a concession. So they were a bit difficult to understand in any case.
Turks, did you ever get in touch with the Turks?
Of course, not with any of the other soldiers. Indians, really.
The Indian medical unit.
They were very good. I didn't come across any of the Swedish MASH people, which were there. They were our Norwegian MASH. They were our mobile surgery hospital. I didn't have any of that either. I did go and see Sally in the Norwegian hospital, but that time I didn't even know he was in Syria. That's what happened, actually. To finish off the story, the battalion actually left Korea in early September 1953, having been released in the first place by the Warriors. I then did claim the patriation, and I waved them goodbye on the ship going to Egypt, because they both to Egypt. And I went, stayed a couple of nights. We had those battalions stayed in Busan for about 2 weeks, I mean, playing hockey, playing cricket, and played in the Commonwealth Senator. When they left, I went back to the transit camp, and a couple of nights later, I was sea was absolutely dead calm, There was a ripple on the planet going through the Sea of Japan towards Kure, with all these sort of pagoda-shaped things sticking out of the sea. And at dawn, sun coming up, and we'd see it on the water. It was really fabulous. And I went to the Commonwealth Base in Kure. I went along and had a look at Hiroshima. The story was that it was Kure, which at that time was a big naval base, Japanese naval base. That was the planet and Hiroshima. It was still flat. They were trying to rebuild it. And I stayed in transit there for 3 weeks. In the meantime, I went and watched. I went to visit Savage in the hospital. One or two other soldiers were there. Played a lot of cricket. It was an idle time, really, so that's not good. So it took me home to was around about early October. So it was 3 weeks.
I didn't ask you, I think Jim Leveridge took over the company. Now, what was he like?
Jim, quite great. He was very, a very efficient, enthusiastic soldier. He'd been practically in every serious sort of war, in the Middle East anyway, from France to from North Africa to France. And he'd go and see him on the way. He knew what he was doing. He was always on the ball. He was always a step ahead of what was necessary. I mean, he could have commanded the battalion, no bother at all. And I always had a great respect for him, and he had a great respect for me as well. I remember meeting him after many, many years. We had the Austin Club, Austin Dinner Club, have a celebration in the sub-18 of the Korean. I think it was the end of the Korean War. And Jim came over to me and he said, I'm sorry, really, that word, he said, but one of the bravest men I've ever met. And I said, that way, Jim. I said, Jim, you're a joke of wearing the MC. Anyway, yeah, we had a chat, and he's dead now, of course, he died a couple of years after that. Yes, I always had a great respect for Jim.
And his company, did his company reciprocate with that respect? The men?
Yes, that's what it was like, you know, they respected him. Because he was such a good soldier. What he used to do was when we were in Camp Casey, had battle dress, and he used to drape his battle dress over the chair, and this chest full of medals was gleaming at him as he was walking into his tent, you know. And he never used to wear anything. He used to just drape it over the seats.